For our blind and print-impaired audience, the North Carolina Reading Service presents... The Indie Week, dated October 27th of 2021, and it's read today by John Federson. Brilliant music today, and it's from the Lyrebird enclosure over at the Audubon Birdery. Incredible birds, not native to the U.S. They only assigned a single bird who could do all of these parts at once. Incredible. I'm told here that he can also imitate our credit card beeps over the phone, and so payment has already been received for his services. Better investigate that after the articles are over today, and I better get to those articles. And here we go. First off, I read last week and the week before some of the Indie Week's 2021 election endorsements, and I will just reprise those because the next Tuesday is the election. I'm recording this on Thursday, the 28th. So here are the, just very shortly, a list of their endorsements. They mention that one of the Ward 3 race in Durham City Council, one of the candidates is a child of a staff writer, and so they have not made an endorsement in that race. But the other ones are as follows. For Durham County Mayor, Elaine O'Neill. Ward 1, Deidreana Freeman. Ward 2, Mark Anthony Middleton. And then Ward 3, no endorsement. In Orange County, Chapel Hill Mayor and Town Council, Mayor endorsement is Pam Heminger. And four seats in the Town Council, there are three recommendations, Camille Berry, Paris Miller-Fouché, and Karen Stegman. For Mayor of Chapel Hill, Damon Seals. And three seats on the Council, and they endorse two, Barbara Fouché and Danny Nowell. For Hillsboro, Mayor Jennifer Weaver. Board of Commissioners, they endorse Rob English, Kathleen Ferguson. And for the Chapel Hill Carborough City School Board of Education, three seats, George Griffin, Risa Jenkins, and Mike Sharp. Now, again, if you need to hear or want to hear their reasons for their questionnaires or their longer version of why they're endorsing those particular candidates, you can go to IndieWeek.com, or you can go to the last two Indie Week broadcasts read by me, where some of those are listed in a little bit more detail. All right, and that's it for the election endorsements. And I'll take just a little bit of time to mention Jesse Jones' Halloween house downtown Oakwood in Raleigh. He lived one block away from me when I lived there for many years, and I watched that house develop to almost a theme park. He's got so many figures, dinosaurs, and full-length things, spiders everywhere. It's made the national news by this time. But here's a small interview with him, Jesse Jones, who created the house. Why do you all go all out for Halloween? He says, when I was growing up, my dad saw Halloween as a waste of money. Not a religious thing, but we just didn't really do it. Sometimes you feel kind of left out when other kids were getting dressed up and had cool costumes. I've always been able to create crazy stuff, so I always wanted to do something for Halloween. Boy, he did. Now my dad comes and participates, and he thinks it's the greatest thing in the world. And I'll just interject that sometimes Oakwood Avenue has to be closed off for a couple of blocks because of the number of people going there. You put up a lot of frightening decorations. Is there anything that scares you? He says, I had a really bad fear of witches. Right up until high school, I had to have a light on. I couldn't see a witch or I'd get really upset. The cool thing about it is I married a witch. One of the decorations is a sign that says the Wicked Witch does live here. That's directed specifically at my wife. She doesn't like the Halloween production. She says my front yard looks like Walmart threw up. And I tell her, you can't get this stuff at Walmart, honey. Are there any new decorations? Yes, I'm making a whole pirate skeleton scene on one side of the house. When I finish it, it's going to be dedicated to my mom. She had severe schizophrenia her entire life and obsessed with pirates. She died 4 months ago, so it's still close. What do you like about celebrating each year? Well, I hope he likes like 2,000 or 3,000 kids coming up and down the street, because that's what they do. If you come to my house on Halloween, you see every race, every nationality, every religion, everybody's there. It's so cool to see that. I think Halloween shows people, hey, this person is exactly the same as you. Only thing different is their skin color. When they're dressed in a costume, you can't tell. I'm also the lawyer for the Harnett County NAACP, and I do a lot of civil rights cases. With Trump, it got so bad, I've made political statements along with the decorations. Now that Trump's gone, I'm trying to cut back, because I want everybody to come to my house, not just the progressive liberals. What's your favorite thing about Halloween? I grew up in a big family, so I love being around children. The same kids from the neighborhood come by every day and help me decorate. Every year, the same children come to visit. So that's Jesse Jones. Now an article by Jeremy Carballo Pineda in the Voices series. It's the first in a multi-part series about the author's experiences as an immigrant to the U.S. from Central America. How do you tell your childhood friends you're moving schools because you got evicted? You don't. You lie through your teeth until it becomes second nature. What do you say to a college peer who asks about your birth country, even though you have no memory of it? You lie through your teeth until it becomes second nature. Time runs astray as you reminisce about a time when it was just you and your mom, Maria. You were her first child. She had you at 21. She had her whole life ahead of her, like you do now. You two were raised alike, well, to a degree. You attended public schools in North Carolina, never skipped a free meal at school, laughed along when a white kid called you Beaner, but kept moving forward. You are the oldest of three and the first to have a home away from home. Maria is the oldest of three. Maria has two younger sisters. Maria's mom, your grandma, worked as a janitor for the local hospital. On occasion, when your grandma needed an extra hand and her monthly check arrived, she and Maria would walk down the street to the outdoor market and buy fresh cheese. She literally needed an extra hand. As a kid, your grandma fell from a tree and her left arm was amputated. Maria played the role of the eldest sibling in a working-class family a little too well. She won a scholarship to a private high school in Nicaragua, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. She borrowed her neighbor's skirts and shoes to fit the dress code. She was the only kid from her neighborhood at private school. Maria had never been surrounded by so much opulence before. Don't get so happy. The role of the eldest always comes first. Your grandma needed her to work. A scholarship can't pay the rent. She dropped out, began working, and took night classes at a local high school. She graduated after many long nights. You wish you could hear her tell her story. You can't help but tear up as she smiles through it all. Before you were born, and after graduating from high school, Maria settled in Costa Rica. Let's just say that Nicaragua isn't flooded with opportunities. Currently, your aunt in Nicaragua can't afford to pay for her toddler's diapers. Although that doesn't reveal much, Maria couldn't afford your siblings' diapers in North Carolina either. When you were three, Maria and you walked through the smoldering deserts of Mexico. That's when she cared for you. She could not bear to raise a child in her birth country, and you could not bear to stop crying when you lay in the bed of the blue pickup truck. It was covered by a plastic tarp. You two were hiding underneath, headed north, away from your grandma, away from your birth country, Costa Rica. The tarp screeched as the wind tested its endurance. She held you close and put her hand over your mouth. Border Patrol ears are attuned to the distressed child's voice. Her hand tasted like a saltine cracker that's been dropped in sand. Your tears must have slipped in. When you were bright-eyed and four, you experienced one of Maria's firsts. You were there for many of her firsts. She ate her first burger and fries with you. YouTuber in New Jersey in a Wendy's soon after your exodus from Central America. You wore a buzz cut, the cheapest haircut. Cheeks chubbier than the Michelin man's. You used to smile ear to ear. Your cheeks would overpower your slender eyes. Your eyes would disappear from joy. There's no need to see when light-hearted ignorance is penetrating the air. You and Maria had caramel skin, but New Jersey isn't that sunny. The desert's rays must have caramelized the both of you. Your time alone with Maria came to an end in second grade. You were 7. Giovanni, your brother, came into the world. You were still learning English then. Dora the Explorer became your tutor. You and Maria had settled in a small town in North Carolina, Lincolnton. It had a vibrant Costa Rican community, and Maria became a cook at a local Hispanic bar. She hated it, but the experience came in handy years later when she cooked for you and your siblings. Giovanni was always by your side, and you were by his. You changed his diapers. You were the only one who understood his gibberish when he was learning how to speak. You slept by his side. You taught him how to read. You taught him how to write. You two have the same nose. Both of your apexes drip over like a teardrop. An eternal reminder of your blended reality. You and Giovanni shared many living spaces over 11 years. Living spaces, a euphemism for cars, family friends' houses, women's shelters, bunk beds, sheets on the floor, mattresses in different rooms, but you don't remember all the locations, so living spaces fills the gaps. Through every eviction, every new school, every new living space, you were there for Giovanni. He turned to you when he needed clarity. In the absence of clarity, you turned to God and pleaded, "Let the suffering end, let the tears end, save us." It didn't matter that Maria would take you and Giovanni to church 3 times a week. Nothing changed. You realized, only I can make it end. I will end the suffering one day. You calmed yourself and thought, memento mori, you will die one day and the ordeal will be over. Until then, you are the oldest and you will commit to your role. So you calmed Giovanni. You assured him there would be better days. You knew the story would repeat itself every day, every week, every year. You knew a retrograde was inevitable, waiting to unveil itself at any second, so you slept in perpetual fear. You never admitted this to Giovanni. You wanted to preserve his joyful ignorance for as long as possible. You wanted him to forget about the fighting, forget about the solitude, forget about God, and find peace within himself. So, you lied to him, lied to yourself, and you continued to lie, and you never stopped. Hannah Olson, now about Meredith Pruitt's campaign for the Board of Education, Chapel Hill Carrboro. Meredith Pruitt is not your typical candidate for the Board of Education. For one thing, she's a registered Republican in one of the bluest counties in the state. For another, she's raised a lot more money than any of her 5 opponents in the nonpartisan race, likely the most ever in a local school board race. This, combined with a vague platform and a handful of high-profile conservative donors, means Pruitt has garnered much more scrutiny than other candidates. She's emblematic, some parents and activists say, of a local iteration of right-wing infiltration of school boards by conservative candidates hoping to launch their political careers that's playing out nationally. Susan Hester, a Chapel Hill resident and political activist, in an email to school system parents that was forwarded to the Indy, warns, "Beware the right-wing effort in the Chapel Hill Carrboro school board elections. School boards are the entry point for many elected officials, and the right wing is maximizing that tactic." Pruitt did not respond to Indy's multiple requests for comments for this story. According to her website, Pruitt is a 10-year resident of North Carolina, originally from Boston. While in North Carolina, she served as the chief of staff and senior vice president of the UNC system under President Margaret Spellings from 2016 to 2019. Prior to this, she worked for Davidson College, where she served as special assistant to the president of the university. Most of Pruitt's career, however, was spent working in national politics, including as a senior advisor to Spellings, who was then U.S. Secretary of Education under George W. Bush. As a vice president of external affairs for the National Association of Charter School Authorizers in 2009 and at lobbying firms. Spellings, who donated $500 to Pruitt's campaign and officiated Pruitt's wedding in her 2020 marriage to her husband, Jonathan Pruitt, the chief operating officer of the UNC system and former vice chancellor for finance and operations at UNC Chapel Hill, left a sour taste in the mouths of many. She was selected secretively after the UNC system board of governors fired Democratic system leader Tom Ross. In 2005, as education secretary, Spellings wrote a public letter to PBS condemning gay characters in a children's television show. She went on to make disparaging comments about LGBT lifestyles around the time she was appointed as the UNC system president in 2015. Chris Segro, the director of Equality NC, at the time of Spellings' appointment, wrote, "Ms. Spellings has been a vocal opponent of the gay and transgender community. Our school's administrators are responsible for creating safe environments for our students to learn without distractions. Spellings does not have the needs of North Carolina's LGBT students in her interests." Along with Pruitt, Reza Jenkins, Mike Sharp, George Griffin, Tim Sukram, and Ryan Jackson, they're vying for spots on the CHCCS board. According to her 35-day campaign disclosure, Pruitt raised $14,000, blowing the other candidates out of the water. Next in line was Jenkins, who raised $2,100. He himself was the largest contributor. Candidate Griffin has amassed $1,000. Sukram, Jackson, and Sharp have not filed finance reports because they're not spending more than $1,000 in their campaigns. A large chunk of Pruitt's cash haul, $4,820, came from herself and several relatives. Among other top donors are a number of well-known Republicans, John Prayer, who's current vice chair of the UNC Board of Trustees, nominated by State Senate Phil Berger, is known for voting against tenure for Nicole Hannah-Jones and was the lone vote against the moratorium on renaming UNC buildings named after white supremacists. He contributed $1,000 to Pruitt's campaign and has a track record as a major Republican donor. Other conservative donors include Lauren Maddox, a Washington, D.C.-based lobbyist who also worked under Spelling, and Andrew Miracle, who is related to McMichael Textile Manufacturing Magnates. Both contributed $1,000 to Pruitt's campaign. Nina Ocharenko, a senior research fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation and a member of the Trump transition team, gave $200 to Pruitt's campaign, and $250 came from Holly Kuzmik, the Dallas-based executive director of the George W. Bush Institute. CHCCS parent Karen Herpel wrote in an email to Indy, "They are literally trying to buy the seat. Her signs are everywhere. Mailers have hit people's boxes. Pop-up ads are on the web, and she has a professionally designed website sprinkled with educational buzzwords." Such buzzwords and right-wing talking points, which include goals of, quote, data-driven decision-making and, quote, focusing on the fundamentals, reading, math, and science, fill Pruitt's website, and she has repeated them when speaking publicly. While it's not clear what data Pruitt would use to drive what kinds of decision-making, critics say that focusing on data is a way to avoid having to address the equity issues that exist in public schools, especially around race, a topic that Pruitt has been seemingly loath to address. Pruitt has also alluded to data informing decisions to keep students at home during the pandemic, with which she disagreed. As she said in a recent candidate forum hosted by Tar Heel Teachers, "One of my focal points of my platform is I think students need to be in school full-time learning, and I would say that hasn't happened over the past year and a half, and we could have done a much better job in thinking about data points that came down from the CDC or American Journal of Pediatrics or whomever it was who had some thoughts. At the same forum, she said she supports having armed police officers in school, saying, we live in a world of laws and rules, and we need some sort of enforcement when things get violent, and so having some trained safety officials on site at these institutions makes some good sense to me. It's kind of common sense in that regard. Some public school advocates say campaigns like Pruitt's are indicative of a growing national movement and that we can expect to start seeing conservative foundations donating money to elect school board candidates, a piece with a broader strategy to undermine public schools and teachers' unions through the school choice and voucher movements. Carol Burris, executive director of the Network for Public Education, an advocacy group with a mission to preserve, promote, improve, and strengthen public schools, says, earlier this year, Steve Bannon started talking about the way through towards victory for Republicans was through local school boards. It's not a coincidence. It's part of this strategy, and it's been a somewhat effective strategy. The movement has culminated, post-pandemic, in heightened scenes at school board meetings, with attendees railing against mask mandates and straw man issues like critical race theory education, to the point that most parents, quote, don't even understand what is happening in terms of instruction in their school, in Burris's words. Put another way, it's a means to excite the base. Burris says, Republicans certainly seized on the pandemic as a way to get a good foothold into all this by promoting the narrative that parents were very unhappy with their local schools during the pandemic. All of it is incredibly disruptive and incredibly discouraging for the professionals who dedicated their lives to work with children. If you're out to destroy what you consider to be a government school, what better way to do it than to create chaos? But Pruitt's supporters, including a local nonpartisan group that formed to petition for reopening schools during the pandemic, comprised of several dozens of CHCCS parents, are trying to steer voters away from the partisan narrative. Pruitt is the only candidate the group endorsed. In an email to the group's listserv, Layla Stambaugh, a psychologist who donated $250 to the campaign, wrote that the group doesn't endorse the Republican or Democratic candidate, quote, but rather voting on the issues. We have seen some emails attempting to paint the school board election as overly political. Our group includes parents from across the political spectrum. On the issues of protecting in-person instruction and putting students first, we believe that Meredith Pruitt remains the best candidate. She writes that Pruitt is the only candidate talking about, quote, the fact that 40% of students are not reading at grade level, and the only candidate who has acknowledged the learning losses accrued from remaining in remote school for over a year. And it goes on, we don't foresee any of the other candidates bringing real change to the board in terms of focusing on the learning and emotional needs of all students in the district and getting away from the overuse of online technology in everyday learning, in particular for the youngest students. The email also mentions using bullet voting, where voters vote for only one candidate for the three open seats, as a way to shore up support for Pruitt. Pruitt herself has pushed this strategy to her supporters, too. The email states, so many of these candidates are same old status quo, and that will do nothing but perpetuate the recent and current directions of the board. It's not a requirement to vote for three board members. This strategy is alarming to voters like Hester, the political activist, and parents like Herpel. Despite some nominal support from Democrats and the unaffiliated, Pruitt's campaign finance records show a $500 donation from Lindsay Kelly, the press secretary for Teach for America and a registered Democrat married to Andrew Kelly, senior vice president for strategy and policy for the UNC system, and Pruitt's former colleague. Many in the community still view Pruitt's campaign with skepticism. Herpel wrote in a widely circulated email that was forwarded to Indy, Her candidacy is the Republican Party's first true attempt to infiltrate this school district. As we have seen, they've been extremely successful in wielding power and therefore policy down the road at UNC Chapel Hill and across the state at every level of government, including school boards. Her candidacy is a strategic, well-funded effort to get a Republican on the CHCCS school board. Now, Jasmine Gallup weighs in from Raleigh with an article called Walking in Two Worlds. Olivia Richardson is an aunt, accountant, and dog lover who works for a construction company in Raleigh, but she's also someone else, a Native American. Richardson, a member of the Haliwa-Saponi tribe, hails from Hollister in Halifax County, where she grew up learning about her tribe's culture, language, and artistic traditions. In Raleigh, Richardson often feels like she's walking in two worlds. She says, being in a city setting that's not close to a tribe, you have to be able to find ways to continue to be in touch with your heritage. You want to be able to live what we call American life, as well as hold on to your indigenous ways and traditions. That feeling of living a double life is common for Native Americans, says Christina Theodoro, a member of the Lumbee tribe. For her, going home means seeing her family, but also getting back in touch with her tribal roots. She says, when you are from a tribal community, you kind of live in two worlds. You live and you function, and you work your day to day. But you have to go home to have that cultural connection. You have to spend a lot of time on the road to get that boost of energy and good medicine that comes from going to a tribal powwow. Sandon Jacobs, a member of the Waccamaw Siouan, says living in Raleigh can sometimes be challenging. He says, we're so spread out. When you go around the Lumbee community in Pembroke, Native folks are together. They live down the road from one another. They go to church together on the weekends. Raising a family here is a lot different. I do miss that experience for my kids, being immersed in Native culture. It's nice to be around people who have your lived experience. Jacobs and the 168,000 other Native Americans who live in North Carolina will have the chance to come together Saturday at Raleigh's Intertribal Powwow at Dorothea Dix Park, the first funded by the city. Raleigh officials' decision to literally invest in the indigenous community means a lot, says Richardson. They've taken it upon themselves to acknowledge that there were indigenous people who lived here in Dix Park. They're saying, we want to take the time to appreciate you, to allow people to witness you. In Raleigh, powwows at local colleges are regular but relatively small events. There have been attempts to start a large annual powwow at the state fairgrounds, but they faltered due to lack of funding, says Jacobs. And he says, this event feels different, like the start of something lasting. In the past few years, recognition of Native American communities has increased. In 2018, Governor Roy Cooper turned Columbus Day, once a celebration of Christopher Columbus, who led the conquest and extermination of hundreds of Native Americans upon landing in South America, into Indigenous Peoples Day. Recently, local officials have also acknowledged land in the state that once belonged to Native American people. Jacob says policy changes like these and cultural programs like the Dix Park Powwow should be conversation starters. He goes on, as the Native people living here, it's up to us to make ourselves seen, to show up in the community, in our schools and workplaces, and our politics, to make sure that the history of the indigenous people in the state isn't just glossed over in a couple of pages in your fourth grade textbook. North Carolina has one of the largest indigenous populations in the United States, with 8 tribes and 4 urban Indian organizations. But many think of Native American culture as extinct, Theodoro says. She says, our presence truly hasn't been known. There's not really been an acknowledgement of indigenous culture in the Triangle. That's partly because there is not a tribe specifically anchored in the Triangle. she says. The closest community is the Okanichi tribe in Hillsboro. Powwows help a wider population understand that Native American communities are alive and well, Theodora says. Moreover, they educate people about Native American culture. The Dix Park Powwow is exciting, an emotional event, she says, but it's also an opportunity to reduce the stigma and stereotypes associated with Native American communities. She goes on, when you are an Indian who lives in a city, an urban setting, oftentimes you're one of the only Indians that's in your school or your job. You're constantly asked questions that are offensive or ignorant. We need to have frank, open, and honest conversations about what people don't know about tribal cultures here. The Trey Roberts, the community engagement manager for Dix Park Conservancy and a member of the Haliba Saponi tribe, says powwows are time to come together. It's a moment for us to celebrate our culture. Up to 1940 or 50, it was illegal for us to even dance. Powwows are an opportunity to gather and dance and celebrate what we're proud of, our artistry and culture and things that have been passed down to us. The all-day celebration, again, this is going to be this Saturday, I believe. That's right, this Saturday at Dix Park. The all-day celebration will include dancing, drumming, and singing with performances by former Miss Lumbee, Alexis Reyna, and singer-songwriter Charlie Lowry. Jacobs, a singer and MC, will perform with the Stony Creek Drum Circle, he says. Their higher-pitched style of singing comes from the Northern Plains area around the Great Lakes. He and other members of Stony Creek will be singing in the Tutelo Saponi language. Richardson, meanwhile, is one of the lead dancers for the powwow, alongside Patrick Green. She'll perform the Jingle Dance, a healing dance that originated in the West. In the story she was told, the dance healed a young Native girl who was very sick. The girl's grandfather saw the dance and the dresses worn by dancers in a vision. The story is told in many different ways, but that's the version Richardson carries with her. Every time she dances, she tries to think of someone who is in need of healing. She says, I always take the time to pray for someone who might be sick. I pray for someone who went through the loss of a family member. I pray for someone that's going through depression. The dresses are heavy, but when you're wearing them, the weight tends to distribute across your entire body. As I'm dancing, I try to think of that weight as someone's hurt or someone's sickness that they're going through. I carry that on myself, just enduring it and helping them endure it as well. And I'll mention that the article here about the Dix Park Intertribal Powwow does not mention any contacts, information about admissions, or any details about this. And it may be that IndieWeek.com has more or links to anything, or there may be that it's just free to attend. And from Tomasi McDonald in Wake Forest, use of force. In the latest episode of Triangle Police Officers Using Force Against Residents, video footage of officers smashing a vehicle's window and dragging a woman to the ground went viral last week. In a video taken on a cell phone, exactly 1 minute and 14 seconds elapsed before a Wake Forest police officer used his expandable baton to shatter the driver's side window of Maria Carmen Del Rendon's sport utility vehicle. Wake Forest Police Chief Jeff Leonard defended the officer and a second cop who yanked Rendon out of her SUV and took her down to the ground alongside a busy highway. Rendon was hit with a battery of charges after she refused to open her door and allow police to detain her son for questioning. In the days that followed, a video of the October 15th confrontation, originally posted by TikTok user at Beyond Ciabarra 48, went viral. Rendon isn't talking to the media. It's not clear what the TikTok poster's relationship is to Rendon and her family. Leonard, in a press release, explained that his officers wanted to detain her juvenile son, who was wanted on charges of felony strangulation, and that the police were forced to react in a situation that was entirely avoidable. Leonard said none of this would have happened had Ms. Renda not recklessly fled the scene, endangering the lives of her young passengers and motorists in the area, and had she exited her vehicle when officers repeatedly asked her to do so. Most of our residents offer no resistance during the calls we respond to, but unfortunately, in this case, we met resistance at every turn from Ms. Rendon and the male suspect. In a separate statement released by the town of Wake Forest, described as the police effort, quote, to add more to video of driver's removal from vehicle during Friday's traffic stop, Leonard noted that before his officers were seen on video, Rendon drove off and, quote, came close to striking an officer with her vehicle before running a stop sign and nearly colliding with an oncoming tractor trailer. Police charged her with resisting a public officer, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, driving while her license was revoked, and aggressive driving, according to arrest warrants filed in Wake County District Court. But even though Leonard says Rendon came close to striking an officer, she was not charged with assault on a law enforcement officer. Leonard noted that his officers were investigating accusations that Rendon's son had strangled a 14-year-old girl and, quote, the male suspect refused to cooperate. Rendon's family spoke with Indy this week and added context on her behalf. One family member said the police officer who first approached her in the neighborhood where she lives would not tell her why they wanted to detain her son. Rendon had also insisted on being present when the officers questioned her son. Juveniles have the right to have a parent or guardian present while being questioned by police, according to state law. The Wake Forest Police Department's 21-page use of force policy outlines definitions of resistance and when the use of force is authorized. It also includes a section on when it is appropriate for an officer to de-escalate a potentially volatile encounter with a citizen instead of escalating the situation by resorting to actions such as breaking their car window. After listing the authorization of force to prevent assault, injury, serious physical injury, the threat of harm, and death, the policy notes, quote, where circumstances and time reasonably permit, an officer shall take reasonable and prudent actions which operate to mitigate the immediacy of the threat, thereby giving the officer time to call more officers, utilize other tactics, or request specialty assistance, such as crisis negotiators. Leonard says it was just after 2:30 p.m. when officers stopped Rendon's SUV after she had turned out of her neighborhood on Plot Hound Lane and onto NC-98. The video, a little over 13 minutes long, begins with an officer whose last name, Minor, is emblazoned on his uniform. He tells Rendon to open the door on the passenger side of the SUV. No, no, Rendon answers. You can come this way. Minor then tells her while wielding the baton, you're going to open the door or I'm going to open it with my stick. Rendon is reportedly on the phone with an attorney and explains what is happening. Meanwhile, Minor whips the retractable baton down, causing it to expand. Open the door now, he says. I don't want to break your window. Along with her 15-year-old son, Rendon's 13-year-old daughter and two younger children are in the SUV. You're going to break the passenger window? Minor nods while saying again, open the door. Where my children are you serious? Asked Rendon. One of the smaller children in the back seat starts to whimper. Minor smiles and crosses over to the driver's side of the SUV where he tells her, ma'am, step out of the car. He adds, you have a choice. You either step out of the car or I break your window and pull you out. He then tells her she has to five to open the door. A voice can be heard over the phone telling Rendon to ask the officer to slow down. Minor never reaches five. He gets to three, backs up, and uses the baton to smash the SUV window. Rendon yells, he just broke my window. He just broke my window with all of my children in the car. Rendon's smaller children scream and cry, let her go. Rendon's older daughter yells as Minor and Officer S.C. Stone pull her mother out of the SUV. The officers take Rendon down to the asphalt road. For about 8 seconds, one of Miner's hands is clasped around Rendon's neck. Stone has pinned the woman's leg. "Let me go. I can't breathe. I can't breathe," she yells. "You can breathe," Miner tells her while moving his hand away from her neck. "Relax." Later, while handcuffing her son, Miner can be seen jerking the teen's handcuffed wrist upward near his shoulder blades. "You're twisting my arm," the teen tells the officers. His younger sister starts crying. The smaller siblings wail in terror. At least 11 more minutes pass in the video, showing the children standing alongside of the road waiting for an adult to drive them home. The older child tries to stop her younger siblings, repeating, "Stop crying." Rendon was placed under a $3,000 bond, according to a release order. She's declining comment publicly. The Wake Window branch of the NAACP did not return emails and phone calls to its office last week. Town Commissioners Bridget Wall-Lennon, Adam Wright and Chad Serre, and Mayor Vivian Jones all declined comment because the incident is still under investigation. Richard Keith Shackelford, a Wake Forest attorney who is a candidate in the town commissioner's race, offered guarded comments, saying, "I respect our citizens too much to jump to conclusions, and I respect the police department." He's practiced law for the past 25 years, first as a defense attorney and now as an estate attorney. "I want to see more facts." Well, Rachel Simon from the arts department of IndieWeek wants to let us know about 8 Triangle Area Halloween events and activities. Get out the candy corn and start carving those pumpkins. Halloween, a perfect holiday, is fast approaching. While many Halloween activities in 2020 were subdued or outright canceled due to the pandemic, Triangle residents still managed to make the most of the holiday by dressing up in elaborate costumes and adorning their houses and storefronts with decor. This year, though with restrictions loosened, there are plenty of events for locals to partake in. And plan your nights accordingly by checking out the Indies Roundup of 8 intriguing options for your Halloween this year. 1. Go on a haunted trolley ride. Raleigh residents know there's no location in the area creepier than the Mordecai House on Mimosa Street. Not only was the home built in 1785, making it older than the city itself, but legend also has it that the ghost of one of its late former residents, Mary Willis, haunts its walls. Curious? See the house in all its spooky glory this Halloween on the haunted trolley, which take riders on a late-night tour of downtown Raleigh's most supposedly haunted spots. Hitch a ride on October the 29th or 30th for $10 a ticket. If you're looking for an adults-only celebration, but you fear tolerance isn't what it used to be, Chapel Hill's Spring Haven Farm has just the thing for you. At Booze, B-O-O-S, and Booze, B-O-O-Z-E, guests are given a full range of the farm to check out all the animals, along with drink tokens, a Halloween treat bag, and the option to enjoy henna, tarot card readings, and other activities. The 21 and over event takes place on October the 28th, and tickets go for $55 each. And that's tonight. This is the 28th, I do believe. Get the spookiest car wash of your life. In the mood for something a little different? Get in your vehicle and head to the car wash, because not one but 2 Triangle businesses are offering haunted versions of the cleaning process this year. At the Car Wash Lodge in Garner, drivers can go through the Tunnel of Lost Souls for an interactive, ghoulish experience, while Raleigh's Splash Car Wash promises a frightening night of clowns, car washes, shakes, and shivers to drivers who dare to participate in its Night of Nightmares. The Car Wash Lodge event occurs on October 29 and 30 from 7 to 10 p.m., $24 per car until the day of the event, or $30 on-site. The Splash Car Wash will be on October 29, 30, and 31 from 8 to 11 p.m., $20 a car. Watch The Nightmare Before Christmas outside in the park, and that's Moore Park in downtown Raleigh, right downtown. That's will be tomorrow night, Friday night, just pay attention to the temperature and the weather then. Showers are possible. Every Friday between October 15th and November 12th, Moore Park plays home to Cinema in the Square, where visitors can take in a classic movie and some pre-show entertainment under the stars. Every Friday. Keeping in the Halloween spirit, October 29 will feature pumpkin painting, costume contests, and other themed activities, followed by a screening, The Nightmare Before Christmas. The event is free. Food is available for purchase on site. Dog owners, this is for you. High Wire Brewing in Durham is holding a Pup-O-Ween, also known as a costume contest and celebrations for canines and their owners. Dogs will be judged in categories including scariest and bartender's choice, so make sure your pup is in its best and most creative form. The event, October 29th from 6 to 8 p.m., with a free-to-enter contest beginning at 7. High Wire Brewing in Durham. No address is given here in this article. Plenty of Triangle breweries and tap rooms are hosting Halloween-themed events, but Crank Arm Brewing Company especially caught our attention. The downtown Raleigh spot is offering a group bike ride, where costumed riders will decorate their bikes, take a stroll through town, and compete for prizes. It happens on October 30th from 6 to 8:30 p.m., and is free to participate. Just make sure you bring your helmet and motivation. And I, John Feddersen, also advise you to, if you're going to dress up in flowing things, make sure that's the sort that don't catch up in your spokes. All right. If you dare, and experience a phantasmagoria. For those who prefer their Halloween celebrations to be more eerie than full-out scary, Duke Homestead State Historic Site and Tobacco Museum in Durham offers a Halloween phantasmagoria, where visitors can wander the property while learning about spiritualism and maybe encountering some surprises. Just take it from the event copy, which promises that it will be like unlike any other Halloween experience. If you dare, buy a $10 ticket and stop by the homestead on October 29 from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. All ages are welcome, but those with young kids might want to sit this one out. And finally, what better way to close out October than saying goodbye to your good old pumpkin at Bond Park over in Cary? Attendees at the Pumpkin Flotilla bring their own jack-o'-lanterns and watch them set sail across the lake at twilight, of course. If you want to be seen closer to the action, you can hop on a boat ride. Discounted tickets are available to those who enter a pumpkin or sport a costume. The event on October 29th goes from 4:30 to 7 p.m., and pumpkins will set sail at 6:30. They'll be relit the next night, though, October 30th, if you're busy on Friday. But don't want to miss out on the fun. That's called Ahead of the Carve, this article. I should have read that. And luckily, I have time, I believe, to read an entire music article. It's the cover story about Dante High, the biggest local band in the world. And it's titled Ari's Inferno, written by Brian Howe. Ari Picker's favorite part of our interview was when I told him some of the musical references I had heard on his new album, Dante High 2. A frothy and exhilarating pastiche of the guitar and synth music of classic rock radio through a modern indie sheen. To me, Deeper Love sounded like a blend of Porches, which Picker had never heard, and Tears for Fears, which he ranks with Depeche Mode as an analog production ideal. But really, he copied the idea of the stormy opening soundscape from the first Black Sabbath record and filched the beat from former Eagle Don Henley's soft rock hit, The Boys of Summer. Victims of Victims, meanwhile, sounded like the stylish French band Phoenix, which Picker admires but doesn't especially follow, covering Blue Oyster Cult. It mainly just because of that cowbell. He says, I was trying to do a David Bowie, Rebel Rebel kind of thing. He was sitting in his home studio in Pittsburgh with the analog gear that makes Dante High's new album feel more live than its software-leaning debut. A Yamaha DX synth here, a modified Oberheim DMX drum machine there. And he says, or something Stonesy, where the progression doesn't change. Can you carry a song that way? That was the exercise. Worthless Dreamer, I thought, sounded a lot like the Outfield's Your Love, a song that rips off the Police so hard you might assume it's theirs, as produced by the horror icon John Carpenter. It's natural to consider Dante High in cinematic terms, and not just for its saturated, widescreen colors and sound effects. The name itself implies some purgatory between 80s teen comedy and the divine comedy, an impression bolstered by the two albums' sequel titling. You got that one, Picker says of the Carpenter crib, though the slasher movie Ostinato is also basically a slowed-down version of the synth line from Depeche Mode's Black Celebration. He adds, I'm not opposed to stealing at all, if it's obvious and fun. It is. Some musicians wouldn't warm to the suggestion that their songs were collections of citations, but you get the sense that Picker could play this game all day, quite happily, unraveling each strand in a finely woven tapestry of the popular music of his youth. Currently, he prefers it to discussing his more recent past in Lost in the Trees, the orchestral indie pop band that rose from Chapel Hill's Trekkie Records to L.A.'s four-record run that earned Picker a full-time living and a national following, while illustrating both the industry advantages and the personal toll of painful music autobiography. In significant ways, Dante High is about leaving all of that behind. Still, it forms the backdrop for how a new single by a small-town band that has played about 10 shows in 4 years could earn more than 25,000 Spotify streams in one day, as Deeper Love just did. Usually these rare local shows are special events at skating parks or skating rinks, not standard nightclub dates, and that tradition of quality over quantity continues in Dante High's Halloween Bash at Shocorri Hills, with guests like bassist Will Hackney, saxophonist Daniel Chambo joining core members like drummer Pete Lewis, guitarist Thomas Costello, and keyboard Emma Nadeau. Picker headlines a weekend of music, arty, and spooky happenings and camping. Expect to hear the new music, which is on Bandcamp now, but not to bring it home. This is the beginning of a soft rollout, as Picker, it seems, works out a rather novel and bespoke way to be a rock star. He says, laughing, I'm trying to be the biggest local band in the world. It's a striking idea, and one that he specifically might just be able to pull off. They say you have to go big or go home. But why can't that or be an and? When I said I loved the little wolf howls on Carphone, which turned out to be an homage to sample-happy rock bands like Pink Floyd, I didn't know Picker was going to show up for his indie photo shoot in a werewolf costume. A secret connection? Perhaps. Or maybe it's almost Halloween and Ari Picker just likes being someone else. After Lost in the Trees, which released its final album in 2014, Picker was disillusioned with the music industry and the strain of artistic subsistence. He turned his energy to building his house in Pittsburgh, which he didn't know how to do when he started. He used what he learned to build up his own small construction business, got married, and had two kids. In 2018, Dante High's self-titled debut was Picker's unexpected return to music as a lamb in wolf's clothes. The vision first started to form when he recorded with Josh Kimbrough's new wave rock band Teardrop Canyon, which would have been called Joshy K instead if Picker had had his way. He recalls, I was like, it's got to be a name. You've got to be able to create this persona to hide behind it because it's like a theatrical performance. And he didn't go for it. Still, that idea found its place when Picker named his band Dante High, an uninhibited and confident persona compared to the tremulous one of his orc pop days. One inspiration was the metalhead jocks of small towns like Pittsburgh before the internet, the mulleted Mavericks Picker regarded with awe in high school. Another was the music you heard constantly on construction crews, from Judas Priest and Huey Lewis to the Misfits. He says, when I quit music full-time, music just became more fun. I went back to what got me into it in the first place, listening to 80s and 90s radio as a fan more than an artist. Fatherhood also exerted an influence, as Picker found himself awash in Disney ballads, both old and new. He says, there's this kind of stripped-down emotion like love, 110%, not complicated. Coming from indie pop or rock or whatever, everybody's got to be shrouded in this hip thing. But I wanted raw emotion and fist-pumping good times. Dante High took shape over a year and a half. Picker set out to make a direct sequel to the naive and hedonistic first record, but it came out darker than he intended. He says, I wanted to write a working man's record, a party record, like it's Friday, let's get some beers. Instead, it's like, I hate my boss, I need to go on vacation. I think there's this constant buzz in the back of my mind of everybody working themselves to death. For time reasons, I'll have to cut to the end of this article. If Dante's High's good times are shot through with darker threads than Picker had planned, perhaps it's just a sort of an afterimage, a delayed reaction. Some dreams and their attendant fears take time to fade, even as better realities arise in their place. He says, I'll run little visuals in my head, like with Addicted to the News. I'll see a big concert and the band's playing the song, and all of a sudden the phone's ringing, and I run backstage and it's my boss. He's like, where are you? Why aren't you at work? So I leave the concert through the back door and drive to work, and all of a sudden, the whole dream of being a rock star is gone, and you're in the daily grind. He adds, the whole thing about love the job, hate the commute thing is about artists, but instead, I'm talking about people driving to work and getting stuck in traffic. That was a long period of my life that was painful to let go, but I'm so much happier now, so maybe that's what it is. I'm happy, but reflecting on that process. And the good times roll on. Well, Indie Week rolls on to a close now. John Federson reminds you that this and many more programs are stored on our website, ncreadingservice.org, and it can be listened to at your convenience. So long for now from the Indie Week.